Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Here's a list of famous names: Paul McCartney, Barbara Streisand, Laurence Olivier, Ella Fitzgerald, Luciano Pavarotti, and Carol Burnett. Surely you know them as some of the most gifted performers in modern history. They are also part of a much longer list of legendary, brilliant artists who have admitted to suffering from crippling bouts of stage fright. More severe than the butterflies many of us experience before getting up in front of a crowd, stage fright can be truly debilitating for people whose livelihoods require them to work while they are the center of attention. But where does this fear come from? Can it be contagious? And what actually works to help those who want to bring it under control? My guest explored these questions in her capacity as a journalist, but also as a person afflicted by stage fright, which began for her as a promising piano student terrified by recitals in her early teens and continued until she vowed to celebrate her 60th birthday by giving a solo recital. Sarah Solovich shares what she learned in her new book, Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I guess I should ask at the outset, does giving an interview trigger any kind of stage fright for you, or was it just about musical performance?
I have nice butterflies in my stomach for something like this. Definitely a few nerves as I think, you know, what am I going to say and what are they going to think about me? I mean, all those, you know, natural things that everybody has whenever they get up to talk. But in fact, my stage fright, for what it is, has always been so piano-centric. It's been very specific, and I've been managed to be able to do other things in my life, that call upon, you know, adrenaline rushes and performing, and have risen to the occasion. And I don't, or have not, has, you know, personally risen to the occasion to that extent as a pianist.
This story fascinated me because there was a time when you defined your identity by the fact that you were a pianist.
Sure, because I think that's so much, you know, how my family saw me and even how my friends saw me as, you know, a young person, you know, right up until I went to college. It was kind of my reputation. And it was something that my mother in particular wanted for me and really drove home. It was more important to her that I be a pianist than even a good student. She kind of took that for granted. But it didn't really matter to her if I, you know, did well or not in school. Anybody could do well in school, she thought. But to be a pianist, that was important. Part of it, I think, came from the fact that her older sister, who had raised her and almost like a mother, who's 10 years older than her, was a great pianist. And I think my mother really wanted me to follow in her footsteps.
Of course, even encouragement can read as pressure when you're the subject of it.
Well, sure. I mean, I can remember when the first piano arrived into our house. It was this, to my mother, it was an enormously important moment. My aunt had come up from the States. She lived in New York, and she had come to Toronto and spent a day playing all the pianos at the Heitzman warehouse, which the Heitzman is kind of the main piano company in Canada, or at least it was back then. And then she picked a piano for me, and when it was delivered and brought up on the veranda and brought into our house, I was bored and, you know, declared that I was going to go out and play. And my mother was just furious with me that I didn't recognize the momentousness of this occasion. And, you know, she clearly, I mean, you know, practicing every day became something that was very much expected of me. And she would chase me around the dining room table, sometimes with a wooden spoon, to go and practice.
You say that she broke some wooden spoons. You don't describe your mother as abusive, but she broke some wooden spoons chasing you around.
Yeah, I'm not sure if she actually broke them on chairs around the table or on me, but I do remember on numerous occasions her calling my father at work and asking him to please stop on the way home and pick up another wooden spoon because she'd broken it, you know, just the way another woman would have asked her husband to pick up a quart of milk.
What do you remember, Sarah, about your first experience with stage fright?
Well, there were quite a few, but it probably started when I was around 11 years old. And I would be entered into these music festivals in our town. And there was a lot of music in our town. Everybody that I knew played the piano. And I remember going up on stage and suddenly finding to my horror that my hands were sopping wet with sweat, so that when I sat down at the keyboard, they were just slipping and sliding across the keys. And of course, my fingers were trembling at the same time and my feet were shaking and I had no control over myself and no control over my thoughts. And I had really no way and had been given no way to, you know, to take control over this. So I was playing by memory a lot of these pieces, and I would have terrible memory lapses. And all, things that I could do easily at home and at my lesson suddenly became, with you know, out of my control. And of course, you know, when you're young, and I think, I'm not sure, it probably on some level still exists, but, you know, teachers, private teachers in particular, don't really prepare or think about how they're going to prepare their students for this kind of eventuality. So my teacher would just say to me, imagine that, you know, everybody in the audience is a barnyard animal. They're all cows and pigs. Or at another time, she told me, imagine that everybody is naked in the audience. Well, that probably made me more nervous than anything else. And that was kind of the extent of what I was told to do. And everything, and every year it was like, okay, you're a whole year older now. You're going to be fine. Mm. But instead, there was this feedback loop that had, you know, just come into being in my own. It was almost cellular. And so I remembered what had transpired the previous time I'd performed. And I just, I came to expect the same, you know, thing time after time. My mother just thought all I had to do was practice and I'd be fine. If I practiced enough, that was the key.
Can you put your finger on what you feared exactly?
Well, for me, I know it was competitive and evaluative. I was being judged, and I literally was being judged, because there was an adjudicator, sometimes several adjudicators in the audience, usually halfway down the hall. It wasn't just a simple teacher's recital. It was a festival, and it was competitive in nature. And say everybody would be asked to play a Bach invention, maybe, you know, when we were 11 or 12 years old. And we would get up and, you know, people would be playing different ones, but they were all within a certain, you know, there were parameters for what we were performing. And there'd be people in the audience, you know, adjudicators who were scratching their comments and their opinions and judgments of us on pieces of paper, and then we would be awarded, you know, based on that, you know, who won. So I think I was definitely responding to, you know, to a fear of evaluation.
Stage fright is fascinating because it's a condition that seems to defy any sort of logical talk down, right? So after a point, it didn't matter if close friends would ask you to play at the point that you had stopped performing competitively or that you were guaranteed to have a friendly audience. The fear was real, even if by some calculations it was illogical to be nervous to play in front of people.
Definitely. And also what happened, which was very interesting, and I even found this going back to the piano 30 years later, is that I would be playing a piece that, you know, I would say I'd go back to some sonata that I had played 30 years earlier, and I realized that I would actually make a mistake oftentimes in the very same place that I had made it, you know, like as a child or a teenager, right? And so I think it was almost like, and it wasn't necessarily a difficult place, because sometimes when you're playing the difficult, you know, passages, you're just so in the moment. But other times when things start to open up and it's an easier part of the piece, I'm thinking, oh, okay, I'm doing really well now. I wonder, you know, how I'm going to, you know, what do they think of me now, for instance? I start to become self-conscious, and that's when I lose my focus and I make the mistake.
You say that quitting the piano at 19 felt final to you, and you equate it to maybe leaving the faith that you'd been raised in. And I thought that was so remarkable, because sometimes those kind of leave-takings can be really liberating and yet surprisingly sad at the same time.
I think for me, the piano and music seemed, had a very religious kind of connotation for me. I remember it was many years before I realized that the word practice could be applied to anything beyond piano or music, that you could practice, you know, a religion, you could practice meditation, you could practice, I don't know, whatever. For me, practice always implied sitting down at the piano and working.
We've all heard that statistic that, you know, most Americans fear public speaking more than death. And we hear it so often that we just assume it's true. In fact, as you discovered, it's slightly more complicated than that.
There are a few of the studies have found that there are, you know, people have said that they are more afraid of playing or of performing than they are of death, but it isn't quite the joke that that Jerry Seinfeld made. The studies are just kind of all over the place about it.
How common?
I'm blanking right now.
That's
sorry.
Okay. How common is stage fright?
There are an awful lot of us in the closet. I'll say that. I just constantly meet people who tell me that, you know, they want to tell. As soon as I admit to it, people immediately tell me that they want to tell their stories, too. They say that up to 30% of musicians in symphonies take beta blockers, for instance. But I've heard that the figure anecdotally is a lot more. I think that most people have stage fright on some level. You know, you get up to talk and, of course, you know, you feel a little nervous or you have some butterflies in your stomach. But it's the people who just can't get beyond that, who are, you know, who are so incapacitated by their fear that I would call real stage fright.
Can stage fright be considered a mental disorder if it only occurs under these really specific conditions?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the DSM-4, the, you know, psychiatrist Bible, in fact, did used to categorize it as a kind of social phobia and a condition that had to, you know, that was medicalized. But they've done that in so many areas. And that's steadily been discounted. For instance, a lot of sports psychologists say that it's a really normal response to a high-stakes situation. And if you don't respond like that, there's something the matter with you. In fact, you need adrenaline to give a great performance. You need to be excited. You need to, you know, have some passion whenever you get up to speak or act or, you know, play the piano or any other instrument. But it's not necessarily, you know, it's not a pathology, in other words. And when I worked with some performance coaches who were both, they both considered themselves sports psychologists. And sports psychology is being used for so many kinds of, you know, endeavors besides sports now. They discouraged me from even, you know, kind of analyzing why it affected me, what my background was, what, you know, trying to analyze why it happened, and just accept that this was a very natural response to getting up and performing and figure out a way to channel my adrenaline and center myself and make it a kind of a natural but exciting time.
We're speaking with journalist Sarah Solovich. Her new book is called Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies Program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Sarah Solovich about her new book, Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. If you have a question or a story to share, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Sarah, can stage fright be contagious?
Yes. I think that all fear is contagious. In fact, there's a fascinating study that was done in 2006 by a neuroscientist at Stony Brook, where she collected the sweat of skydivers, novice skydivers, just moments before they leaped out of an airplane on their first tandem jump. And then she used a nebulizer to waft the sweat particles into the nostrils of completely different people when they were lying in fMRI machines. Mm. And the fear centers of their brains, the amygdalas, just lit up. So she concluded that, in fact, you know, when it comes to, you know, human social dynamics, stress is, in fact, contagious. There have been other accounts. There was one very notorious account in Leroy, New York, a very little town in upstate New York, where a group of cheerleaders began exhibiting all these bizarre social tics and twitching so that they almost looked like, you know, walking around like they were zombies. And the people became convinced that there had been some kind of environmental disaster in the town. They actually called in Aaron Brockovich to investigate. But it ended up being diagnosed as mass hysteria. And people, you know, they realized that it was, you know, they had to stop talking about it and giving, interviews to the press. And it soon died away.
Which probably explains why professionals who deal with this are reluctant to speak about it publicly or with their peers for fear of, I don't know, becoming a pariah.
Yeah, it's very much a taboo subject. It's most musicians, especially classical musicians, do not talk about it. And very few of them admit to taking beta blockers, even though the reports, you know, kind of within the community and the surveys that have been done show, you know, quite to the contrary, that, you know, up to 30% of them do. And I've been told many more than 30%, in fact, take beta blockers. But yes, it's considered something that nobody wants to talk about. It brings them bad luck, and they don't really want to, you know, engage with others who are, you know, and I can certainly appreciate that. I've felt that myself.
You made some calls. This is really interesting to me because we think of stage fright and we think of people who are performing, but people like preachers and rabbis, people who get up and you know, give sermons once a week, they can be susceptible to this as well.
I heard of a rabbi who actually gave up his congregation, just walked away from it because he could no longer stand the pressure.
Wow.
I've talked to pastors who said that every week was a countdown to Sunday. I went and visited a preacher in Kansas who was just, you know, every week, I mean, starting on Friday, he would start to have gastrointestinal problems and just become, you know, even to the point of throwing up before speaking, before, and what was often, a very small little parish. So, yes, it affects people on all kinds of, you know, in all kinds of places and endeavors.
So this is really interesting. You, for years, lots of your friends had no idea that you even played the piano. You mm-hmm. could have just decided to, you know, hang on to your stage fright, never again play for anyone. Tell us about how you decided first to fully understand what this thing was that had affected your life and then to do something about it.
The two things really converged at the same time. And intellectually, I found it a very exciting project. Emotionally, I was horrified by it. And it took me really a few months before I was really even able to commit to it. But I think that if I hadn't decided to make it a project and write about it, I would have weaseled out of it.
Hmm.
So having kind of like, you know, put like you know, staked my commitment, as it were, and, you know, gotten a book contract allowed me to, you know, I knew that I could not walk away from it, which is what I had been doing my entire life. I had been, you know, hiding from it and not talking to, not telling anybody about, you know, people were surprised, you know, when they heard that, oh, you play the piano? I had no idea you played the piano. So I had taken about 30 years away from it. And my youngest son, who was starting to become very interested in jazz, at that time he was playing clarinet, wanted me to start playing with him and improvising along with him on jazz. And I had never played jazz. I had been very classically trained and didn't really know the first thing about how to begin. So I called a friend of mine, somebody who played both classical and jazz piano, and he didn't know I played the piano either. But I said to him, you know, can you just show me a few progressions? And I figured one or two lessons and, you know, I'd satisfy my son and that would be the end of it. And so my friend said, sure, but it's been 30 years since you've played the piano. Why don't you just go back and start with some classical music and get your hands back into shape. And then from there, we'll go to jazz. Well, once I started playing again, that was it. I just fell in love with music to an extent that I don't think I ever loved it as, you know, a teenager. And I never went on to jazz. I just became completely obsessed with the piano. And I started playing probably 2-3 hours, you know, an evening. Whenever I could get a moment away from work or family obligations, I was at the piano. And that went on for several years until eventually I decided there were a couple little things that happened, but I realized that there was no purpose in doing this, in investing so much of my time and energy and passion in this, if I couldn't even play for a few people. And that's when I thought I really needed to, it was unfinished business and I had to kind of go back to it. And I figured that if I would just spend a year of my life and I would look at, you know, the science, the psychology, talk to other performers, musicians, but all, you know, and performance coaches, and work with a really great teacher and kind of address, you know, like what worked for me, look at all kinds of remedies, then I could lick this thing.
One aspect of your journey was a form of exposure therapy. So talk about how you began to acclimate yourself just to the idea of performing for even very small numbers of people.
Well, I quickly realized that probably the most important thing I could do was to actually do it. Mm-hmm. And it sounds so simple, but it was very painful. And anytime I could avoid doing it, it was, you know, especially in the early stages, it was exactly what I, you know, avoided doing. So I remember I once was asked, my very first teacher asked me to play for just for him, his wife, my son, and husband. Sitting on the sofa in front of the piano and watching me and hearing me play. And I started playing this Debussy prelude that I'd been playing for probably a few months. And halfway through, I just lost it. And I couldn't, I think I, my nerves just acted up and I had a few missteps and I got so angry at my teacher and I just took the music and I threw it across the floor and said, Landis, it's all your fault. and I just got up and was about to leave and they all encouraged me to, you know, no, go back, finish it. And I did. And it's funny because now he remembers that as being a really... seminal moment where I, you know, I did do it. I finished the piece. I went back and I played it again, and I accomplished that. I remembered it, on the other hand, as being a real failure for me, which is really typical. I mean, I just, you know, will go back and perseverate and think, you know, like, why did I make a mistake here? How could I have, you know, held myself together better? And that's something that I've really had to work on and just let go of.
Are people who have stage fright somehow more conscientious than their peers who don't, or more prone to anxiety in other situations?
I don't know. My phobia is so piano-centric that it doesn't seem to really affect me in other ways of my life. For instance, you know, I mean, as a journalist for many years on, you know, big city newspapers, I could always rise to the occasion when it came to deadline writing. And, you know, my adrenaline would start to flow, and I channeled it, and I felt more alive and completely, you know, just thrilled. And I never missed a deadline. I'm able to get up and talk before groups of people, but put me in front of a small audience and I'm terrified at the piano. So for me, it was very specific. But I do think there must be, like, you know, some people theorize that, yeah, people like us have, you know, more adrenaline than others. It's, you know, so you can't control it. It's harder to just channel all that excitement. So you need a beta blocker for it to help dampen some of it. Certainly with the symptoms that I had were so physiological, you know, the sweating and the trembling, that I think it would be very hard for me to control that even now in in higher stakes situations when I'm playing. When I go to the airport, on the other hand, I no longer take a beta blocker.
How does the beta blocker take the edge off? Like, what's the difference between taking one, I don't know if it's half an hour before you start or whatever, but and not taking one?
Well, first, I should say that it's a very tiny dose of beta blocker. It's 10 milligrams, and, you know, I usually take about, you know, half of one. Mm-hmm. But what happens is kind of more notable for what doesn't happen. You don't really feel any different. It's not like you're high or aware of it or kind of more focused or anything like that. It's that your hands, in my case, my hands don't sweat. I don't shake. I don't tremble. I don't feel my heart pounding. So it's kind of an absence of symptoms rather than any additional symptom. On the other hand, you still have to do all the mental work. You still have to focus and channel and center yourself and be completely in the moment. And I still get excited, but then I'm able to then say to myself, I'm excited, instead of, you know, what I in the past would have said, I'm so nervous.
Talk about that centering yourself. One of the mentors you turned to, that was the primary advice. Can you explain how that works and how you learn to do it?
I kind of thought of myself when I first started doing it. It was Don Green, who's a sports psychologist, and he had gotten into the... It was very interesting, an interesting story. He had become involved with musicians years before when he was on a golf course. And a musician, a bass player in an orchestra back east, had approached him and asked him about how to improve his putting, I believe. They started talking, you know, on the green, and he heard that Don Green was a sports psychologist. So Don Green very generously started, you know, kind of putting, you know, had him answer a lot of questions. Kind of, he had a whole inventory of questions that had been written up that kind of gauges a person's natural, you know, own nervousness and ability to perform. And he put this musician through the inventory and helped the guy out a lot with his golfing. Well, the guy quickly recognized that what he had been given was totally applicable to music. And he invited Don Green to Syracuse, New York, and to talk to all the musicians there. And Don Green quickly became kind of like a coach to people. And his name started spreading, and he was invited to start working with singing students, voice students at Juilliard by a faculty member there. And he began working with them and was so successful that all of his students placed very highly in auditions that they were performing in. And from there, Juilliard hired him to be a faculty member. And his main teaching for all his students, and certainly for me, was about centering, how to center yourself. As he worked with me, I started thinking kind of about, using a hula hoop and moving my body and the center of my body to the hula hoop. And that became very useful. But it's also something, that you do in a yoga class, too. It's how one balances oneself and maintains balance in a yoga class when other people around you are losing their balance. So, actually kind of calls up the whole idea of contagion, too. I mean, you watch other people start to fall, and of course, you lose your balance. So that became an important part of my approach to the piano. And as Green insisted, I was never, ever to play a single note, not a scale, not a piece, not to sit down at the piano without first centering myself.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Sarah Solovich about her new book, Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sarah Solovich about her new book, Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we have David on the line in Arlington. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to have a quick story about, stage fright and then later overcoming it. I was in eighth grade. I think I was like 14. And I was running for class president, and I had choreographed this whole show, and instead of just getting up and giving a speech, I created like a rap type music number to kind of really wow everybody, and because nobody, the other candidates weren't doing anything like that. So I got up there, and I was about maybe 2 minutes into the deal, and everybody started clapping and kind of cheering, and even though I was getting positive response, I just literally froze. I had no idea what my next move was, what my next word was. I had to just walk off stage because I had, like, flatline in mentality. I couldn't do it. And then later on, I was just so disgusted by that and overwhelmed by that for years that I ended up participating in a huge lip-sync contest at our high school my senior year in front of, like, 300 people. And I ended up winning third place in that because of, my performance. And so I went from one spectrum to the other, and I just kind of wanted to share that with, how you can overcome stage fright.
Thanks so much for your call, David. Is there anything you can relate to there, Sarah, the positive response but still freaking out?
I think the positive response is nothing like it, and that's why we continue to get up and go back to it over and over, to just have a little reminder of that wonderful positive response, because we're all suckers for that, right? I remember when I was 14 years old and I played in a festival, a somewhat bigger festival than I'd been accustomed to, and I made some mistakes, but in fact I got a very the adjudicator gave me second place, and this kind of collective gasp went up from the audience, and it was almost like there had been this political revolt, and he had to kind of hold up his hand and as if he was stemming the tide and explain why he had given me the prize. And it was, there's no question. I mean, those kinds of events are incredibly, rewarding, and they're what bring us back to playing over and over again.
And later on, when you were working on your own stage fright, one of the best pieces of advice you got was that mistakes here and there are not a big deal. It's the best performances are played with passion.
Right. That perfection is really the enemy of a great performance. And of course, I'd seen that over and over in my own experiences of being an audience member. I mean, I've been to so many concerts and performances that, in which, they're note perfect and they completely lack all passion and they're boring. And conversely, performances where somebody screws up and yet you're completely transfixed by the passion and the moment that they bring to it.
Where's the line when you're trying to avoid stage fright and give a good performance between, people tell you to clear your mind and at the same time they tell you to focus? And I've never understood, I don't suffer from stage fright, but I've never understood how you could do those two things at once.
Well, one teacher once told me that when you practice, you're practicing like a cold-blooded scientist. And when you play for God. Hmm. And so I think when you actually get up and perform, whether it's to give a speech or to play a piece, you just want to be so kind of immersed in the situation that you're kind of keeping it all together, but you're, and so you remember, you're thinking where you want to breathe and, exactly what you want, a passage to sound like, and you're in that moment, and you at the you just have to let it go at a certain point. It is kind of a paradox.
You mentioned earlier that one of the things that motivated you to try to get a handle on this was your son, who was studying music and wanted you to improvise jazz with him. Two mm-hmm. of your sons actually grew up to be professional musicians. You worried early on that maybe there was something in you that would transmit this fear to them.
Yes. And when my middle son, who became, he's a classical violinist, but when he started getting really serious about it, and specifically when he was in conservatory for a graduate program, that's when he really developed stage fright. And it became quite crippling for him at a certain point. And I did feel like I had passed on a bad gene, that there was something, almost hereditary in this, even though I had never seen any evidence before. He had just, had been the kind of person who would stand up and play better when he was, in front of an audience than he did in the practice room. But I think when he, decided that he really had some skin in the game, that this was important to him, he recognized how, the importance of it started to become very daunting to him.
How do you practice today?
At the piano, you mean?
Yes.
Just practicing a piece?
Mm-hmm. Is it different from when you were younger?
Yeah, very, very different. I mean, I think when I was younger, and particularly when I was practicing to perform, I would start at the beginning, and if I made a mistake, I would just go back to the beginning and have to play it all over again. And that became really important to me, to be able to play kind of seamlessly throughout. And I think there were times that, if I was easier on myself in the practice room than I was on the stage. It's something that it's a kind of a curious thing that I think happens to a lot of musicians. We become much more self-critical when we hear a mistake at a performance than we do. We're much more forgiving, you know, when we're actually practicing. The other thing that's kind of interesting about it is that often when I practiced as a young person, I would imagine a critical audience for myself. I would imagine that, you know, I was playing for people who I was competing against. And so, you know, that, they would want me to make a mistake and I'm going to prove that I can't make a mistake, you know, that I'm not going to make a mistake. Or I would imagine a judge in the audience, you know, writing little things down, just a hostile audience, which is what a lot of performers do. And now when I practice, I think I try to only focus and not think about anything but the work at hand, and not think about the past, but also not think about who I'm playing for.
I think you have so much to be proud of for having taken this thing that really got in the way of something you loved for decades of your life and confronting it and overcoming it to a great extent. I wonder, along with feeling proud of yourself, if you also wonder where your playing would be if you'd continued for those 30 years.
I don't know. In the book, I wrote that I actually felt like Ivan Ilyich in Tolstoy's story, that I had just somehow missed the boat. I had lived my life all wrong, that I had somehow not understood what it was to learn what it takes to be really good at something. And I think I didn't really recognize that till I was an adult. In some ways, that's, I think, the greatest gift that studying music gives a person, whether they stay with it or not. I don't know. I never really wanted to be, I think my family wanted me to be a concert pianist. And I never saw that in my cards because it was clearly like something that was just not natural for me. Writing, on the other hand, it came so easily for me since I was, you know, really young. I don't really think that. I guess I wish I had continued playing. I wish I had done, you know, that I had spent more time playing music with other people. Hmm. And it was a very isolating experience for me. So I wish I had done more accompaniment, more ensemble work, which I've started to do as an adult.
Sarah, many of us have been present when somebody called on to get up in front of a group, and sometimes it's, you know, a meeting at the office, and sometimes it's a big speech somewhere, sometimes it's a performance, seems to be really struggling with something that looks like stage fright. Is there anything we as an audience can do to make things easier?
Good question. You know, the one thing that helped with me, I had, you know, in addition to playing at the airport on many occasions, I also had what I called a number of soirees where I would invite 10 or so people over to my house on a weekend evening and play for them and then serve dessert and wine. And especially in the beginning, I would play a couple pieces and inevitably make a mistake and become chagrined and lose my focus and feel really awful about, you know, like what an idiot I was. And they would say to me, play it again, play that piece again. It's so beautiful. It's not important that you made a mistake. I bet you'll play it better this time. That was very useful for me. And it also kind of just confirmed for me the value of doing it over and over. But I think in public, the response that so many audiences have to another stage fright is, I mean, sometimes horrifying, and sometimes it's almost funny, right? Mm. I mean, I cited the case of Donald Verrilli, who's the attorney general who got up to argue the case of Obamacare before the Supreme Court. And he had, I mean, here's an incredibly accomplished lawyer who's argued before the Supreme Court many times. But as everybody heard in his talk, which, you know, in the recording, was he kind of lost it. And he became really nervous, and he stuttered, and he couldn't get it together. And everybody just made tremendous fun of him. And all the blogs, I mean, major blogs, laughed and accused him of, you know, bringing Obamacare down. If Obamacare lost, you know, this was a few years ago, it would all be his fault. So people, I think, take real a kind of snide, you know, backhanded pleasure in watching somebody, especially somebody who's accomplished, fall to pieces because of performance anxiety.
Yeah, I always think about athletes. You know, the entire crowd in the stands, it couldn't think of doing the things that the people on the field are doing, and yet they don't mind criticizing.
Yeah, look what happened to Steve Sachs in 1983 when he lost it. I mean, you know, I think he made something like 30 errors over the course of the summer, and he went from being this, you know, great all-star to just being persona non grata. He was actually getting death threats, all kinds of letters, you know, where people were, you know, accusing him of, you know, taking the Dodgers down and wanting to come after him and kill him. And he had ended up having to give some of these letters over to the FBI. It took him, you know, months before he was able to kind of just return to an, you know, equilibrium.
Do you feel like your stage fright is something that you are over once and for all, or like a chronic illness that you've learned how to control?
No, it's not like, you know, planting, you know, your flag on the moon and saying, you know, it's over now. I've triumphed. I've overcome it. It kind of comes and goes. And I've encountered that with other people, too. And it's just something that I constantly have to, you know, just remind myself and work with and be present for. And, you know, I can never, you know, if I'm going to perform, and it's not something I'm going to do a lot, but I want to be able to continue doing so in small ways. It's not something that I'm going to be able to take for granted.
The new book by journalist Sarah Solovich is called Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. Sarah, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and we had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Jeff Whittington is the show's executive producer. If you want to find me on Twitter, you can do so by checking out at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.